From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Many of us are entering week six at home, and I'm sure you feel as I do, like you're on a roller coaster of acceptance and denial with itchy feet and a brain that absolutely does not know when to shut the heck up when it's bedtime. We're settling into our new routines, all the while chafing against them. And in the restaurant world, things couldn't be more awful, even with the pivot. There are so many questions, yet so few real answers. And we wanted to bring you some stories from a few of our friends who represent the spectrum of challenges and emotions that restaurateurs all over the country are going through. Their stories are of hustle and hope, and of course, heartache. Christine Moore is the owner of Lincoln and Little Flower in Altadena and Pasadena. I've known Christine for more than 20 years and watched her build a business from a tiny candy company into two thriving cafes. And then overnight, everything changed.
They're both closed. My people have been laid off, and I've paid their health care through the end of next month. And the restaurants are empty. We lost everything. We tried very hard to shift business models in both places. You know, the hardest part is hemorrhaging money as you're trying to go from an in-house restaurant to selling pastries through the glass window. We had tremendous support with minimal staff. It was so taxing on my staff, I couldn't ask them to do it anymore, and we weren't safe. We have a tiny kitchen, and every day I looked at them and I thought, this is wrong. I have to send them home. They need to be safer at home. And after 3 weeks of really, really trying hard to make it work, everyone was exhausted and afraid, and I made the decision to close. And it was hard. Nobody wanted to go home, but I had to tell my staff, you have to go home and be safe at home. We can't run this operation the way we need to with, you know, one third of our staff. It's too much.
As the days go by and you have more time to digest the landscape, which in and of itself seems to be changing day by day, is there any part, any income center of what you were doing before that you feel you can resurrect before we're being told that we can start to reopen?
The thing that I keep coming back to is everything we do in a restaurant, it requires a lot of people, a lot of hands in tiny kitchens. And the safety factor, I'm a mother of three children. One is compromised with diabetes, and my staff has children. You know, we trying to figure out what to do, because anything that we do right now costs money. All the food is more expensive. Everybody I know that's open right now is not making any money. They're barely breaking even, trying to keep people employed. The loans, who can do anything with a loan right now?
What do you mean by that? Who could do anything with a loan right now?
I don't want that PPP loan right now.
Why?
I don't want to put my people back in the kitchen. They've all applied for unemployment. They will all be safer at home. Bringing them back to work, stopping their unemployment, putting them on payroll. The government's going to get, 25% of it back in payroll taxes anyway. It's going to cost me money to run payroll. It's just not a well thought out plan. I don't want to put everybody back in the kitchen. It's not the time for that, in my opinion.
So for you, the big point of decision making, it's all about safety and how close people are together. It's such a unique problem to the restaurant business, I feel.
Mm-hmm. My kitchen is tiny.
Everybody's kitchen is tiny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I really know that my crew, if I said, all right, get back, let's go, but I have fear. I don't want my staff to get sick because I've asked them to come and be in close quarters in the kitchen.
Have you started parsing through a model that requires only a couple of people, but then you mm-hmm. have to decide who those people are going to be?
Yes, and you also have to decide if I hire, you know, back one baker, how much can one baker make? How much can we sell? And are we even going to be profitable? You know, it's kind of the chicken and the egg. Like, how much can we make? How much can we sell? When I was closing my restaurants, the thing that was making me just fall to my knees was, this is 20 years of work, layer upon layer upon layer. And that's what the restaurant business is. It's layers and layers and layers. And every layer was coming undone. You know, we're down to nothing. So there needs to be momentum behind a big startup, and there has to be cash flow. And I'm proud to say that I paid every one of my vendors before I closed my doors. I owe nobody.
But to reopen, that will take yeah. cash.
It takes cash. You know, we lost $100,000 worth of product. And our insurance company sure doesn't cover us for work stoppage on this. We've been paying them for years and years and years, but they don't cover a pandemic. You know, there's a tipping point with the restaurant. It takes years and years and years to be profitable. But once you shut it all down, you have to start over again.
And everyone who is able to reopen will be reopening to a different world.
Yeah. How do we engage? You know, we're such a face-to-face business. The worst thing I could do would be to open and fail again because it wasn't thought out. Then that would be devastation.
The fear, I can't imagine living with, well, I can all too well imagine living with that fear day to day.
You're exactly right. It's terrible fear. Fear of making the wrong move. I have two daughters that aren't going back to college. I can't afford it. They have to get used to their new reality. And on top of it, salt in the wound, I have to stay home and homeschool a 13-year-old boy. That's torture.
I cannot thank you enough for coming and being so vulnerable and sharing what you're going through right now.
Thank you, Evan.
The other side of this coin are the restaurants who have managed to stay open, adjusting daily to new business models, and in the case of Jeremy Fox, working with provisional staff to keep businesses afloat. Jeremy is the chef and co-owner of Birdie G's, Rustic Canyon, and Tallulah's in Santa Monica. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thanks.
What's fascinating to me is how big your takeout menu is. What made you decide to have such expansive offerings? So many other places are doing a very tight, tiny selection.
I don't know. I think it felt like Birdie G's had to be abundant. Like, I don't know, the more we could offer, the more normal things felt, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. You've created five kind of income centers on your menu, on your to-go menu. Can you go through them with us?
Yeah, we have an all-day lunch and dinner menu. We have the larder and sundries. It's basically like a little grocery store. It's anything from flour and yeast, which are extremely popular. Was not expecting that, to like our vinaigrettes and sauces and pickles, things like that. And then there's cocktails, wines by the bottle. We're doing a weekly family meal menu that's available for two or four or six. And that's just kind of trying to create, you know, as close to a restaurant experience as possible, or, you know, what it's like eating here for someone to enjoy at home. But people can also order sliced deli meats. They can order matzo ball soup, you name it.
Can you paint us a picture of what your day is like?
You know, I get there and, you know, put on a mask before I walk in the door and go inside and see who's there and, You know, it's strange to be in a really big restaurant and big kitchen and just see a few people and they're wearing masks. So it's not like any other time, and you're definitely reminded of it pretty quickly of arriving. And, you know, sometimes there'll be things that I need to get in the kitchen and do right away, cooking wise. Sometimes it'll be computer work, kind of jump between wherever I need to be.
You've never hidden your struggles with mental health, and sharing your story has undoubtedly helped many others. Are days like the ones that we're living through now making it more difficult to reach out for help?
I don't think it makes it more difficult. Some days are pretty rough. You know, some days I'm just able to dig in and not think about what's surrounding me and what's impending and just try to get in a zone about just that day. But there's days where that's all I think about is this is happening now, but what's going to happen next? And I think not being able to know it is challenging, but I think everyone in this industry is going through it. And, you know, it was such a sudden, drastic thing. You know, I think there was just being shell-shocked for a while, but I think there are a lot of things that had to change in our industry anyway that were well on the path to change, but this really created a chance to, when things do return, that they don't necessarily, everything has to return to exactly how it was if that wasn't really working.
Things like what?
Just how thin restaurants' profit margins are, the, I guess, sustainability of the job in terms of the hours, the disparity in pay for the kitchen. You know, I think overall just how well businesses take care of their people and are set up to be able to do that.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your strange and busy day to talk to us, and take good care of yourself.
Thanks, you too.
Across town, Lynn Ta and Jonathan Whitener have also managed to pivot, but with even fewer staff. Their restaurants, All Day Baby in Silver Lake and Here's Looking at You in Koreatown, employed about 90 people before the pandemic closed them down on March 16th.
We've had to furlough everyone, myself included. So even I had a paycheck from February that I put back into the bank. To pay for our staff that had worked that last week before the shutdown. When we shut down on the 15th, we still had a week of payroll, in other words, to fund. And that was extremely challenging and difficult. So there is no one on staff.
Wow. All Day Baby pretty much had just opened, was just finding its footing. And in fact, the review came out the day you had to close, right?
It's true, yes.
So what are you doing now at each location to survive?
Well, the more visible location that we're doing things at is at All Day Baby. We thankfully, during construction, had put together a little takeout window over by our coffee counter. So we activated a biscuit window the first weekend after the shutdown. And the reason why we did that was we felt that the biscuit sandwich was one of the feature dishes at the restaurant. And we would serve that out of the window, you know, and do orders online so that people could pay in advance, choose a pickup time, and then come up to the window and take their biscuits and go home. And it went pretty well. And at that point, we were obviously Chef Jonathan are happy, and I are happy to work for free. We brought Tessa in, and she's the creator of the biscuit itself. So we were able to generate a little bit of money from that first biscuit window. We've done another biscuit window since, and then we've also done other different menus. And what we have found is, I think our guests and our community, they're responding to sort of the surprise element of it. It's kind of like going back to the restaurant's roots again and putting some element of, I guess, joy to how we're announcing the events, because I'm sort of putting these website pages together and, you know, how the commerce side of things, it's not normally my forte. So I only have like about 36 hours or 48 if I'm really lucky to give people notice, to go online, purchase these things. And people seem to respond to the excitement of that they don't know what we're going to serve.
So it's like a pandemic pop-up.
It is, yes, a pandemic pop-up. Because what we, you know, the competition is quite fierce for all restaurateurs right now, which is, A, you're competing with the stocked fridge, you know, the fear of going outside, and then all restaurants transforming to takeout. And there's just so many choices. So for us, you know, just throwing in that element of surprise, providing a very, very limited menu, I think helps narrow that decision-making down. And guests, what I've noticed coming back to the window, I mean, they sort of make an event out of it. They're like, I'm going to go to Ollie Baby. I'm going to come at 11:45. And that's my outing for the day. You know, and, they bring the dog. And it ends up being a really nice time. And it's weird to, we have regulars at the window that never got a chance to actually go to the restaurant, which is pretty amazing as well.
So interesting how everything is transforming. So many of us, diners and eaters, want to know how we can help. What can we do as eaters? Is ordering takeout enough?
Ordering takeout is not enough, but it's what we have to work with right now. So that is, I mean, it's just beyond helpful. I'm floored and moved emotionally every time I see a guest or a return guest or these online orders pop up in my inbox when they come up to our window. I think the goal is to think ahead about the future and to think optimistically that, you know, some of us are going to be able to reopen, in which case we can't forget what has happened here. And I'm hoping all of this is a bit of a refresh and a wake-up call to all of us humans that we miss this. And hopefully everyone will go to all of the restaurants that are lucky enough to reopen with much more vigor.
That was Lynn Ta, co-owner with Chef Jonathan Whitener of All Day Baby, and Here's Looking at You. Before that, we heard from chef owners Jeremy Fox and Christine Moore. All three of those restaurant groups have applied for PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program under the CARES Act, and not one of them has heard back. Coming up, how one restaurant pivoted to feeding unemployed restaurant workers and started a movement that spread across the nation.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. In addition to taking care of their own staffs and figuring out how to keep afloat, many restaurateurs have felt a duty to help restaurant workers who are no longer working. In Louisville, Kentucky, Chef Edward Lee, along with one of his general managers, Lindsay Ofsasek, hatched a plan to feed their newly unemployed community out of the kitchen of their restaurant, 610 Magnolia. And their model has grown into a nationwide effort under the Lee Initiative. Chef Lee joins me now. Hi there.
How are you?
We're settling into this now, right?
Yeah, we're in the thick of it. It's going to be a long haul.
Yeah, I think so too. Let's talk about the Lee Initiative. Originally, it was created as a mentoring program for youth and women. How has your focus shifted in the last several weeks?
We've completely shifted into becoming a relief center for restaurant workers who are out of work, who don't have pay, who are in need of food and supplies.
So you started doing this out of your restaurants, but then you expanded. How did you get this idea to expand nationwide?
We started doing this at 610, and you know, we had some local press and. The first night that we did it, we were surprised at how many people showed up. About 300 people showed up for food. And then the second night, we had about 400 people come through in an hour. And we quickly realized that this was going to be much bigger than just feeding a few people a night. And we had a partnership with Maker's Mark already. They'd worked with us in the past, and Lindsay called them and said, you have to see what we're doing, because this is going to be something that's a nationwide problem. And to their credit, Makers took one look at what we were doing, and they quickly pulled funds together and said, can you replicate this nationwide? And I think it took about 5 days. We had 4 relief kitchens up and running, Louisville, D.C., Los Angeles, and Seattle. And in 2 weeks, we had about 14 relief kitchens up and running.
Describe from both sides what the Lee Initiative is doing. First, let's talk about the restaurants that are involved. Is it their kitchens that they're cooking out of using their staff?
Yes. So really, you know, if you think about it, for us, you know, I'm can't travel. So it is less about the Lee Initiative running 14 relief kitchens, but we're really partnering with 14 really courageous chefs and asking them to participate in this program. And we give them the seed money, and they figure out, you know, what specifically they need in their communities, who they need to feed, how they need to feed them, what are the specifics. And each person gets a hot meal and some kind of provisions, supplies, toiletries. It's whatever we can find, and it's whatever, you know, again, each market is specific. In Louisville, we've got a lot of families, so a lot of people are asking for diapers and baby food. In Los Angeles, you know, not as many families, a lot more single people, so they're needing more food and supplies. Sometimes we give out meal kits. Sometimes we give out dried pasta and rice and beans so people can cook at home. You know, over this past weekend, it was Easter, and we got a lot of donations for candy, and we gave, you know, we try to give out Easter candy and baskets to people with families. And though it may seem like a small, trivial thing, I can tell you, you know, for the families that are receiving these things, it's huge for them. It gives them some sense of normal, and it gives them some sense of hope. And really, at the end of the day, you know, more than food, we're just giving people a sense of belonging and the fact that we haven't forgotten about them. These are the people that are the backbone of our industry. And we cannot turn our backs on them right now.
Can you kind of paint a picture for us of what kind of jobs are represented by the people who are coming on that line?
You know, I always say to people when you go to a restaurant, you know, it's your anniversary or it's your, you know, date night or you know, you're going out to celebrate with some friends and you have this wonderful experience at a restaurant and you may, you know, talk to 4 people, you know, throughout your whole dinner experience, maybe a hostess, a manager, a waitress, and a bartender. And that's all that you may see. But the amount of people that went into making that experience happen is it's dozens. There are phone receptionists, there are dishwashers, there's line cooks, there's porters, there's busboys, there are people who work in the office. It takes such a huge effort to make these things happen. And you know, for me, these are the front line. You know, these are the people on the front line. And it's people who, for many reasons, don't have a safety net. They don't have a support group. For many people, they're living paycheck to paycheck. Or for other people, they have a bit of a savings, but maybe they only had a cushion of 3 weeks to a month. You know, even with unemployment paychecks that are coming in, if you have a family, if you're caring for a sick person that's in your family, the unemployment check is not enough.
Who is doing this work in Los Angeles?
So we started with Nancy Silverton, who did just a wonderful job. And she was actually the first kitchen to activate, and she was the first one to come on board. And she was such a champion and a true leader. And obviously, we all know she actually contracted COVID, but as you know, thankfully, just tested negative and is doing great and really never showed any symptoms. So we're so thankful for that. But obviously, she had to shut down her kitchen for safety reasons. And we quickly were able to move on to Jessica Koslow at Squirrel, who has been equally amazing.
You know, it's interesting. For years, I've been watching the restaurant community coalesce and come together in a way that didn't really exist during my heyday during the 80s when I first opened my restaurants. And I just watching what's going on now, I feel like this is a level of solidarity and brotherhood that might somehow transform the industry in ways for good going forward.
I hope so. You know, what is amazing about our restaurant industry, about the independent restaurant industry, is also our greatest flaw, which is that we are so independent, but it also means that sometimes we're not unified and we don't have a singular voice. And we don't have a unified front to approach, you know, Congress, to approach government when there are times of crisis. And you know, this time has really proven that I think it's high time that we all band together and create some kind of a unified voice that can speak to government, that can really, you know, show the world that you know, collectively, we're an incredible economy. We're almost a $1 trillion economy just on its own. We employ millions of people. You know, we just do it independently. You know, people ask me all the time, what's the restaurant business going to look like in you know, a month from now? And I say, I have no clue. You know, I'm just trying to figure out what tomorrow looks like.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for doing the work and for continuing to push it forward.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This means a lot.
That's Chef Edward Lee, co-founder and director of mentoring of the Lee Initiative. We've been discussing the nationwide restaurant worker relief programs. To make a donation or find out if your city is participating in the program, visit theleeinitiative.org. When the pandemic forced us to cancel our yearly pie contest, we decided to take the event online to Instagram with KCRW's Good Food Pie Pageant. I was so moved by seeing all the photos and reading the stories of contestants' individual pies that I wanted to share them with you today. We had two categories in this year's contest, one for the prettiest pie and one for the best pie story. This year's winner for the best pie story is Evan Spain, and this is his story.
This chocolate meringue pie was made whenever my dad would visit his grandmother in East Texas. But it was a family favorite before my dad was born. Sure, he loved the pie, but so did his dad, and his grandfather as well. But it was my great-grandmother Ruth's pie. She is the hero of this story. She's the one who made the pie. It's her hand-scrawled recipe my dad has framed at his house. It shares the page with a recipe for a buttermilk chess pie with raisins and pecans that no one ever talks about. There's nothing about process or time or temperature, just a list of ingredients for the filling. My grandma learned how to make the pie, and so did my mom. My great-grandparents, Ruth and Louis Edgar Robbins, lived secluded life. In the 1930s, being Jewish in East Texas often necessitated discretion, compromise, and a certain level of secrecy. I have been told that Ruth did her best to keep a kosher kitchen, but that she did use and love bacon. I'm told she made a version of chicken and dumplings, where the dumplings were shaped like balls and were made from saltine crackers. My dad once told me that Louis Edgar said, "If you eat enough kippered herring, she can't smell the beer on your breath." My great-grandpa ate a lot of kippered herring, apparently. The pie would appear to me at least three times a year in my childhood, Christmas, Thanksgiving, and my dad's birthday. It was there in the fridge the morning after. There would always be some left over because my dad was the only one that would eat it. The meringue would be limp under saran wrap, and a clear syrup oozed from the pie. It looked disgusting. But one day, for some reason, I tried it. I didn't like it at first. Not all of it. I ignored the topping and was repulsed by the crust. But the filling was incredible. Like the darkest, richest chocolate pudding you can imagine. But better. The closest thing I can find to it in the world is a well-made pot de crème. In my journey to learning how to make pie, this recipe has been everything. Whether I messed up the crust or flubbed the meringue, the chocolate custard was always a success within that failure, and so always worth the journey. But it's also more than that. Waves of trauma can reverberate throughout generations. Like some families, we don't always get along so well. It is not unusual for holidays to pass without contact. Sometimes it's years. Waves of love also reverberate. When certain times of the year roll around, I make a chocolate pie. I know that though we may not be able to share the same space or point of view, we can at least share a slice of Ruth's pie.
Thanks to Evan for sharing his pie story with us and to Christina Wong, who won the Prettiest Pie Award.
Hey, my name is Christina Wong. I'm at Baking with Chickens on Instagram. My winning prettiest pie is a Seville orange marmalade pie with toasted French meringue and a salty cardamom crust. This pie is a twist on a classic lemon meringue pie that I made with sour oranges instead of lemons, and the sour orange curd tastes just like an orange creamsicle. It's topped with a homemade marmalade layer that I made from scratch using David Leibovitz's recipe for Seville orange marmalade. The pie is then topped with a cloud of marshmallowy torched meringue made using fresh eggs from my backyard chickens. Thank you, Evan and KCRW. I had so much fun participating in this year's pie pageant.
Thanks to everyone who participated. If you haven't already, search the hashtag KCRWPie on Instagram, press recent, to see all who entered. I loved your stories, and seeing all those pies made me so very hungry. In a minute, an ode to chili crisp, an essential condiment in the pandemic pantry. That's next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. When considering Sichuan or Hunan dishes, it's impossible to eliminate the role of the chili pepper. While whole cuisines are based on the pepper, it's surprising to learn that they're not native to China. Professor Brian Dott explores how the non-native pepper went from obscurity to ubiquity, influencing not only a country's cuisine, but its language, medicine, and cultural identity. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Evan.
You know, every time I go to a Sichuan restaurant here in Southern California, and I look at these dishes just laden with red chili peppers, I always wonder, it's always like, how did this happen? Kind of like Italian food and tomatoes, you know? How did it happen?
So, I mean, it happened more quickly than I expected when I started the project. So I started the project, like you, I was in a Sichuan restaurant, but I was in Beijing. And I had that same thought. How did the Chinese start eating something this different with that intense of a flavor? Cultures typically are fairly conservative in their cuisine. And so it's usually not something that changes super fast until we get into the 20th or 21st centuries.
Before the chili arrived, what was the way that the Chinese gave their food that sharpness?
So before the chili arrived, they used the same term la for spicy, and they used it for things like garlic and ginger, and then also the native Sichuan pepper or flower pepper, also known in English occasionally as figara, which is a completely unrelated plant to either the chili pepper or the black pepper. So those were typical ones that were used. They used star anise also, and then black pepper eventually is also imported from South Asia into China.
When were chili peppers first introduced to China?
The earliest written record is from 1591. I think they probably means they were there 10 to 20 years before that, but there's no way of knowing for sure. So probably 1570s, 1580s, they get to China. And they're nowhere else outside of the Americas until Columbus. And so probably Columbus brought them back to Spain on his second voyage, so 1494, which means they're getting all the way around to China in less than 100 years, which I think is pretty amazing for that time period.
Are there any records of how they were used initially?
So the earliest record, that's the one from 1591, from the description, it's not immediately clear how the author was using them, but based on where he put it in this rather large work of his, so it's not in his section on food, it's not in his section on medicine, it is on his section on decorative plants.
Yeah, I mean, they're so beautiful. It's kind of natural that at first they were used as a decorative plant. It seems like once it moved from decoration to culinary, it was super embraced. Did it spread internally throughout the country?
Yes, it did. So, you know, of course, like anything pre-modern, it's much harder to track what's going on at the lower levels of society where they're illiterate. So I think it probably is starting pretty quickly in the lower classes as a flavoring, but it does spread throughout the country pretty quickly. There's an anonymous source from 1621, which talks about the chilies being everywhere. And that's also the earliest source that talks specifically about chilies used in dishes. And it's also the earliest source that talks about their medicinal use.
I understand that there was a recipe book that came out around 1790 called The Harmonious Cauldron.
Yes, that's a great title. So that's the one where I get the first really specific recipes. They're still not super detailed, but it's the first time where we get that genre of recipe books, including the chilies. So that's a good sign that the chilies are really taking off.
Brian, how were chilies adapted into the existing regional cultures so much so that they came to be considered indigenous?
So I think, I mean, the two best examples, I think, are Hunan and Sichuan, where they're used extensively. And it's really become a part of regional identity to be a chili eater. I'll use Sichuan as my example. So prior to the chili arriving in Sichuan, so it's inland province, quite a ways from the ocean. It's super hot and humid in the summer, cool and damp in the winter. And so it's important to find ways to preserve food because of that humidity. And so prior to the chili arriving, they already had that tradition of food preservation, which tends to introduce fairly strong flavors into the cuisine. So they do things like smoking, pickling, using a lot of spices, so the so-called five spice. And so chili pepper arrives, it's coming into that cuisine that already has strong flavors. And then when it first is being adopted as a flavoring, it seems to initially being used as a substitute. So it gets substituted for black pepper, which, like Europe at the same time, is imported, so it's more expensive. It also gets substituted for salt, you know, even though it's a very different flavor. But salt, at that point in China, had a government monopoly, although, of course, there was salt smuggling. But that raised the price of salt. And then right around the time the chili was taking off in China, in the early 1600s, there's a some crises in the salt industry, and the price goes up dramatically, making it quite expensive. And so the chili pepper is arriving right, or, you know, becoming more popular right at that same time, and it just takes off from there.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's Brian Dott. He's an associate professor of history at Whitman College. His book is The Chili Pepper in China. If you want to know just how obsessed the world has become with the chilies of China, look no further than Chili Crisp. Even the name, Chili Crisp, it's just so evocative. Jenny Gao makes her own version and sells it under the brand name Fly by Jing. She's here to whet your appetite. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you faring? How are your friends and family in China?
You know, luckily, you know, my family is in Sichuan, which is a little bit further from the epicenter, but they've been hunkered down for the last 3 months now. And from the social media updates of my friends in Shanghai, Beijing, and Sichuan, it seems like things are slowly getting back to normal, which is really comforting to see.
Yeah, these are strange times, and we can all do with a little zip in our lives, which is what you provide. Can you explain what Chili Crisp is?
Sure, yes. So Chili Crisp, I think, is kind of just a term that I've started noticing people calling this type of oil-based chili sauce from China. You know, I first actually read the term in the Mission Chinese cookbook. Danny Bowen referred to lao gan ma as chili crisp. And lao gan ma is this very famous brand, the number one hot sauce brand in China, made in the province of Guizhou. And Guizhou, because that's where most of the chilies in China are grown, they're known for the best quality chilies. So even though Sichuan province might be more known for spicy foods and flavors, Guizhou is as well. And so lao gan ma is a company that's been around for, you know, I think 20 years or so, and built quite a following for their oil-based chili sauce. And it's basically a crispy, textured, very umami, flavorful sauce that consists of fried chilies and different aromatics like garlic, shallots, ginger. And there's hundreds of variations of it that can be found across China. So even though lao gan ma is the largest brand in China, there are so many varieties, just like there are hundreds of types of vinegar-based hot sauces in the U.S. And so in every region, you'll have different variations. The type that we make at Fly by Jing is inspired by Sichuan flavors. So we use a blend of chilies that are famous in Sichuan cooking, like Arjingtiao, which is known for its highly sort of fragrant profile and being more mild than spicy. And also fermented black beans, which is also a specialty of the Sichuan region, as well as this ancient style of Sichuan rapeseed oil, which, you know, is not available anywhere in the West. It's actually, you know, not to be confused with canola oil. It's this nutty profile that has been used for thousands of years in Sichuan cooking for its health benefits and, you know, its high smoking point. It's high in omega-3s and 6s. I think altogether that kind of creates a new type of flavor profile that actually is quite different. I would say it's actually kind of similar to salsa matcha from Mexico. So there's a lot of different components in it, and it's prized for its mouthfeel as well as its flavor.
Yeah, it's interesting. The godmother brand, Lao Gan Ma, is, I think, known for the fact that it has peanuts in it, as well as the crispiness of the chilies. So you're getting your crispiness from what?
Yeah. So even within Lao Gan Ma's brand portfolio, they have several different styles. And the OG version that I grew up eating, and the most popular one in China, is actually one that is majority black beans. But yeah, I know they also have a variety with peanuts, and they also have one with beef, which is available in China, not here.
With beef?
Oh, yeah. Well, the beef chili sauce is very popular in China. So this is my point about there being so many styles of chili sauce that we just haven't, you know, experienced in the West because we've only really known vinegar-based hot sauces here. But there's a whole world of textural chili sauces. And in China, they're all kind of just called like lajiaojiang or doubanjiang, depending on, you know, the region you're in. And it just is kind of this catch-all term that is chili sauce. But in my family, my grandparents, and they all have their own house version. And a lot of the ones that I've had do actually contain beef or pork. Some of them also contain dried shrimp. So anything that kind of adds extra depth and umami.
Now, when you say house brand, do you mean just a batch that people make in their own homes?
Oh, yeah. So, like, okay. I mean, yeah. So every home usually makes their own, especially if you're, you know, from Sichuan, like my family is. It's very common for people to not purchase things like pickles and chili sauces and to, you know, make everything themselves. So, you know, Lao Gan Ma being a Guizhou brand is actually more popular in other regions of China than they are in Sichuan.
So interesting. You know, as a condiment, it kind of reminds me of the Calabrian chili bombs that you see out there. In that there's this recognizable template, this definite recognizable chili flavor paired with a fermented, like a salt fermented chili. But then there's so much variation, like mm-hmm. mushrooms, not mushrooms.
Oh, yeah. Actually, that's now that you bring it up, mushroom chili sauces is also huge in China. So especially in areas like Yunnan in southern China, where they're known for, I think, the highest variety of mushrooms in the world. And so there's, you know, you can find so many different types of chili sauces where it's super chunky and it's got like bites of different types of umami rich mushrooms in it. So yeah, there's just so many varieties.
So if someone out there is lucky enough to have a jar of chili crisp in their fridge, I am not so lucky. And I want you to know that.
We can fix that.
what is the best simple way to use it?
I think the simplest way is on eggs. I think most people have eggs in the morning and it's such an easy thing to prepare. So scrambled, fried, even hard boiled, just on eggs is great. And then it's pretty much like a hot sauce you can put on anything. So I love having it on pizza and pasta, dumplings, noodles. And the most surprising combination, which I like to tell people to try, is on ice cream. It sounds counterintuitive, but it's actually a really interesting pairing with the creaminess and the iciness of the ice cream and the heat and the crunch of the sauce.
Yeah, I'm all over that. Thank you so much, Jenny.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jenny Gao, founder of Fly by Jing. You can order her chili crisp online. Up next, strategies for making the most of that weekly produce box. Stay with us. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman. And it is now time for the Market Report. Jillian Ferguson is here with the latest.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. While many farmers markets across Los Angeles have managed to stay open, the community of South LA has seen the closure of two markets in their neighborhood. Maria Elise DeMarco manages the market at the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Plaza, which shuttered unexpectedly. Hi, Maria Elise.
Hi.
So tell us a little bit about the community where you manage the market.
I live in the community. Unless you are familiar with, even people in Los Angeles aren't often familiar with South LA, it's about 51 square miles, and it incorporates several neighborhoods within the city of Los Angeles, a few unincorporated areas, and a couple of independent cities within. And it's a historically Black African-American neighborhood. It's got a lot of familial connections for me, as well as just a lot of cultural touchstones for Black Americans from all over the United States.
And this market is one of six markets that CLA, the organization, runs. And a few weeks ago, when the mayor shut down all of the markets temporarily until market managers could come up with a plan to comply with the new safety regulations, CLA was very on top of things. They were some of the one of the first organizations to reopen their markets. What happened at Crenshaw? Why did the market not continue?
Well, sometime within the second week of the market, I got a phone call from one of the people that is in management over at the plaza, and they were asking what our protocols were, what we were planning on doing. And I explained to them that we were in the process of coming up with a very comprehensive COVID-19 protocols and plans for all of our markets. And then we found out later in the day via social media that we were going to be shut down the week after. And that was quite a shock to us.
So the issue is that the property owners where the farmers market actually operates are the ones who have told you that you need to shut the market down.
Yes, this was not us. We have protocols in place to be able to make sure that our vendors are safe, that our staff is safe, and most importantly, that our customers are safe.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit more about why this market is so important to the community. I mean, compared to West LA, South LA has, I think, half of the number of grocery stores that there are in West LA.
Yes, exactly. Well, you've got historical factors at play here. My mother's family's been here for 70 years. And, you know, we had certain parts of Los Angeles County had sundown laws. And then my family settling in the area of South Los Angeles they are in was because of redlining. When it comes to supermarkets, that's another one that's been a long problem. And, you know, we walk into stores and you don't know what's going to be on the shelves. And I know that that has been a scene throughout Los Angeles. But again, as you so correctly brought up before, when you have half the amount of supermarkets, the impact's even bigger.
Is there any chance that the market could continue to operate from a different location?
We are looking at that. We have had a desire to have a more visible location for a number of years. And we are working on that. I mean, there's like only so many places to go. And of course, with this new reality of COVID-19 and coronavirus, we have to have enough space to be able to have social distancing.
Well, we really appreciate all that you do. Thank you so much, Maria Elise.
You're very welcome, Jillian. Thank you so much for your interest and your dedication.
That was Maria Elise DeMarco, manager of the Crenshaw Farmers Market at the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Plaza. We've been talking about their efforts to reopen the market. Even in areas where people can access the farmers market, many consumers have opted instead for CSA and produce boxes. And Ben Mims, cooking editor at the LA Times food section, is one of those people. He recently wrote a guide on how to get the most out of that box worth of produce. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jillian.
So where did you get your box from?
So I actually got the idea to write the piece from a friend who had this very problem. She said, you know, I got a produce box from a restaurant. I have no idea what to do with it. Do you have any ideas? And I was like, I think a lot of people have the same problem. So I actually picked up boxes from three restaurants in my neighborhood or close to my neighborhood. All Time, which is in Los Feliz, along with Kismet, which is in the same area, and then Republique.
Yeah, and all of these chefs who run these restaurants, you know, they would source all their produce from the farmers market for their restaurants, and now they're basically sourcing that same produce to create these boxes to sell to consumers.
That's right, and it's a kind of a win for consumers in that way. It also gives you an opportunity to kind of play around with things that maybe you don't normally buy if you go to a farmer's market or a grocery store. So you kind of get surprise ingredients that help you kind of, you know, flex new skills and try out new dishes.
Absolutely. In the piece that you wrote for the Times, you actually talked about using a plant identifier. If you don't know what something is in your produce box, you can actually take a picture of it with this app and it'll tell you what it is.
It's something that I was even surprised actually worked. So I have this app. It's called Picture This. And usually, as you walk around outside, you can take a picture of a flower or a leaf. In my produce box, I got a bunch of very young mustard greens. And I had only ever really used really mature mustard greens, really broad, thick leaves. And these were really thin and kind of frilly. And so I I was like, let's just see if this works. So I took a picture of the leaves with the app, and lo and behold, it brought up that it was mustard green. So it's a good way to, if you're just completely stumped and you have no idea what it is, take a picture and it'll tell you, you know, what you can use it for and different uses for it as well. So it's a pretty, it's a really smart thing to have up your sleeve.
That's so great. So what did you use the mustard greens for?
I made some new things, but I like to keep some things pretty traditional. And so I took the mustard greens, and because I was kind of craving some food from home, which is down south, I decided to kind of saute them in some rendered andouille sausage fat. And so it kind of gave them that kind of like spiciness, kind of garlicky flavor. And then I kind of stirred them back into a pot of just good old classic red beans that I had made as well. So that was kind of a one pot dish that I ate throughout the week over rice or with cornbread, things like that.
Oh, that sounds so good. So give us some other ideas, particularly for all of the greens that we have, the leafy greens, the herbs. What can we do with all of them?
A lot of the leafy greens, I think a lot of people think or tend to think that if they get, you know, greens like kale, or not necessarily kale because you can eat those in salads, but mustard greens, collard greens, or Swiss chard, that you kind of need to stew them down for long periods of time. But that's not really the case. One of my favorite things is to stack all the leaves from whatever type of green that you get and kind of roll them up like a really giant stack of basil leaves, and then kind of thinly shred them as thin as you possibly can across the grain. So it kind of makes these like ribbony kind of like Easter grass of greens. And then those are great to make a salad out of. You can kind of rub them like you would with your kind of favorite dressing for kale, or you can lightly stir fry those as well, like really hot wok or skillet. Throw them in, get them kind of charred, and then take them out and kind of put your favorite dressing on them. I think greens are really great to kind of, you know, enjoy as simply as possible. So those are the few of the things I like to use with greens.
Thank you so much, Ben.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Ben Mems, cooking editor of the LA Times. For The Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
And that's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can always subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My enduring thanks during this period go to the Good Food team: Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Kat Yore, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.